Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Every 4 years, the world comes together to compete in the Summer Olympics. In 1996, the Olympics were held in the exciting city of Atlanta, Georgia. However, all of the buzz and excitement came to a screeching halt when a bomb went off in Centennial Park a week into the festivities. Why would someone commit such a heinous act? What took authorities so long to catch the bomber? And was justice served for the evil acts he committed? This is True Crime Cast.
Welcome to True Crime Cast. I'm Jamie, here with John, and it is beautiful outside, and we're not there.
I know, it's like the same temperature in this room as it is outside, which is a little warm, but we'll make it. I'll be all right.
John has temperature issues.
That, you know, that reminds me, we're doing a re-recording of Bless Their Hearts after this where we talk about quirks. That is not on my list, but it will be now.
It should be. John, we got some people to thank before we jump into today's intriguing case.
Yeah, man, we have two people who joined our $10 level, so they're going to be receiving an autograph and a shout-out on this episode, and they are Craig and Caitlin. So, Craig and Caitlin, thank you guys so much for joining Patreon. We hope you love it over there. There's a bunch of content you can have instant access to now, so we hope you enjoy that.
And we've been able to have conversations with Craig and Caitlin over there, and it's just a great way to interact with our listeners, and we appreciate everybody over there and the conversations we get to have and the unique things we get to share.
This is a funny story about Patreon, but for months, like, I only have Apple products at home, and for months it wouldn't let me, like, some people would send make a comment on a post, and I was able to reply, like, I was able to type it out, but it wouldn't let me send it. I got that resolved this week, so I'm excited to interact even more over on Patreon. So
it's a great
keep
day.
Those comments coming.
We have a really interesting case here today, one from not really our childhood, but one that I remember pretty vividly, but I didn't know all the details until I got into this research. So, John, why don't you go ahead and get us rolling?
I was going to say I do consider this part of my childhood. I've told you about the weird phase I went through where if something big happened in the news, I would like take out the newspaper and clip out articles and kind of keep it in a folder or something.
Yeah.
Well, this happened during that phase. So I remember clipping out things and it was really interesting. But we're going to go to Atlanta, Georgia in 1996. That's the year that the Olympics came to America. And before we really get rolling with the case, like, do you remember the time? Like, do you remember all that and the buildup around everything? Like,
yeah, it is. I mean, you can find the press conferences where they announced that Atlanta got the Olympics. Not only was it coming to America, but it wasn't going to New York. It wasn't going to Los Angeles. It was coming to the southeastern United States. It kind of felt like our Olympics to me.
Yeah, it was a big deal in America, and especially in the South. I know this isn't Bless Their Heart, but I have to tell you a funny story. One of my favorite memories of the Olympics coming to Atlanta, Georgia, was the Jeff Foxworthy special where he did, like, what all the rednecks are going to be doing there in the Olympics.
Nice.
And it was just hilarious.
I remember that vaguely. Yeah.
One of my favorite. It wasn't on CD back then. It was on a cassette tape, but it was gold. I wish I still had that. Anyway, back with the case. So every 4 years, the Olympics are meant to be a time where the world puts aside its political and cultural differences for a time of peace and friendly competition. In 1996, however, with the world's attention focused on the U.S. as it hosted the Olympics game in Georgia, the idealistic hope for the games was shattered when a bomb ripped through Centennial Park in Atlanta, Georgia. When that bomb went off, there were two deaths and over 100 injuries. There were multiple anonymous tips that came through the investigation. And finally, after quite a bit of time, the culprit was arrested by a rookie cop nearly 10 years after this bomb shook the foundation of the 1996 Olympics. And it's a really intriguing story, so we're going to talk more about that now.
The story of the 1996 Olympic bombing really starts with an anonymous phone call that came in on July 27th of 1996. It was the eighth day of the games. They had begun on July 19th, and they were set to go through August 4th. Nearly 200 countries were represented, and there were 10,000 athletes in Atlanta to participate in the games. The entire world's attention was on the city as the athletes competed for gold. This was, if you were in the media in a national way or even in a local way in Georgia, you were there. Everybody's attention was on this. Security was tight. They hired hundreds of new security folks just for this. But in pre-9/11 days, it was a lot more relaxed than it would be today. The Olympic Committee, as they planned, they hired security firms and paid off-duty police officers to provide extra presence and security during the areas of the Olympics throughout the games. In fact, before the games began, the organizers said that the 1996 Olympics had the most thorough security plan of any past games. Now, there was one Olympic venue where the general public without tickets could get together, and that was at Centennial Park. And this was a place where they had all kinds of shows and vendors, and different countries were represented, and there were lots of that's kind of where the media tower was. And here we are 1 week into the games, and on July 27th, that anonymous call came in to 911 in Atlanta in the middle of the night. It came in at 1:03 a.m.
There's a bomb in Centennial Park. You have 30 minutes.
When dispatch got a hold of this call, John, they said that it was a white male with an American accent. I don't know how you tell that from a phone call.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, sure, I guess you can assume that, but there's no way to definitely prove that, right?
True to his word, the caller had planted a bomb in Centennial Park. It weighed 40 pounds, and at 1:25 a.m. on July 27th, 1996, the bomb detonated.
40 pounds seems huge. For, like, think about a 45-pound weight, right? Like, that seems like a pretty big bomb.
Yeah, and just think of having to get it in there. And, I mean, it was in a bag and a backpack, and we'll talk about that some. The park was situated near most of the Olympic festivities. It was really crowded, even in the middle of the night. This is a situation, again, the eyes of the world are on the Olympics, and everybody wants to be a part of it, so it's an ongoing party for the entire few weeks that's going. There had been a concert that was just wrapping up, and a few thousand people had gathered to watch and enjoy the music. The bomb was in a military backpack, and it was left under a bench in the park. Now, not only was the bomb itself large, but the perpetrator had wedged nails and metal fragments in it, meant to be shrapnel flying around to try to cause whatever kind of damage that it could. And ultimately, the shrapnel would do more damage than the explosion itself. When the bomb detonated, the explosion, the shrapnel ripped through the concert crowd. A nail struck 44-year-old Alice Hawthorne in the skull, killing her instantly. It also led to the death of a Turkish cameraman who suffered a fatal heart attack as he was trying to get away. He had been covering the Olympics, and the scare and intensity of the situation caused him to have a heart attack and pass away. And 111 other people were injured by the shrapnel from this bomb.
Later that same day, President Bill Clinton would address the nation from the White House, and he called this situation an evil act of terror. He said that although the investigation was still in the early stages, he did say that this was an act of terrorism. Clinton also mentioned some interesting notes here. He mentioned a heroic security personnel who was able to spot the bomb shortly before it exploded. And he was able to alert the bomb squad, and they were able to begin evacuating the people who were at the concert before the phone call that you heard just a moment ago. As more information came out, one of the hero that did this was Richard Jewell. Now, he was a security guard who was working in the park that night, and he became the subject of many news reports and was really a household name for his act of heroism, just trying to get as many people out of that area as possible. Jewell first discovered the backpack, and he noticed that it was suspicious, and he alerted the police 10 minutes before the 911 call that you heard. After notifying them, he began to clear people from the area, and Experts have since theorized that his actions helped save many lives. So without Jewel noticing that, calling police, and helping get people out of the area, Jamie, we could be telling a much different story about how many people actually got killed that night.
Absolutely. The security folks had gone through training. They knew what to do. I mean, terrorism wasn't a new thing. There had been a couple scares in the U.S. in recent years before that. Seeing the bag just laying there, apparently there was a group around the bench that had been drinking and had kind of been a noticeable crowd earlier that evening, and just a bit earlier, and he was able to go and find them, and nobody laid claim to the bag, and he was immediately triggered that something was wrong.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it sounds kind of silly that a backpack would be suspicious, but this has happened so many times in America. Like, if you accidentally leave a bag unclaimed at an airport, like, it's a big deal. So kudos for him for kind of taking the initiative there and saving the day.
Also, the 911 call, John, that we played and that came in never got to people at Centennial Park. Have you heard that story?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so Centennial Park was a large park, and it was on the bench in the middle of it. The caller didn't give an address of Centennial Park, which is usually what you do when you call 911. I need help at blah, 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 John and Jamie Street. They didn't give an address. So the dispatcher had to spend time looking up the address of Centennial Park and then had a miscommunication with the dispatcher, and they were going back and forth about how to spell Centennial.
Oh, my gosh.
Nobody at the park knew about the 911 call. It was a suspicious bag, but had they known that somebody called in a bomb threat, I think they would have, because essentially what they did was establish a perimeter like 25 feet away. They would have gotten everybody out of there if they knew about the call, right?
Wow, and that's like what it was like to live in the world before the internet. Like, you could have quickly done a Google search, and even if you misspelled it, it's probably going to pop up, you know? So that's what life was like before the internet.
Yeah.
The FBI began to complete a criminal profile of the bomber to really get an understanding of who could be considered a likely suspect. As part of that profile, they believed that the bomber would be a lone wolf and would be acting independently for a particular cause. And guess what? That description fit Richard Jewel.
Okay, so let's go into that a little bit. Yes, they decided that this was a lone wolf person. They didn't think this was an act of terror from an organization for whatever reason. The only reason they thought that it fit Richard Jewel was because one of his previous employers at Piedmont College, where he had worked in security and that didn't end well, the president called the FBI and said, if you're looking for a lone wolf, your so-called hero is somebody to watch. He's the type of guy that would plant a bomb just to save the day. And that had been done before, John, at the Olympics, actually. A police officer had planted a fake bomb to look like a hero. So that wouldn't have been a new thing. But the president of Piedmont College is the one that kind of initiated Jewel as a suspect. And then the FBI, seeing that, kind of crafted their profile further around Jewel.
Yeah, man. So 3 days after the bombing, he was being praised by the media and by the president of the United States as a hero. But then 3 days after the bombing, a Georgia newspaper reported that Jewel was being investigated by the FBI as a possible connection to the bombing. So, I mean, this does a complete 180. And this guy's being praised as a hero, and then the next minute, he's being slammed for possibly being the suspect who planted the bomb there in the first place. For about a month and a half, the media just completely turned on Jewel. And he was still known around the world, but now he was being traded as the likely suspect behind the bombings. The media claimed that he planted the bomb under the bench while working, cleared spectators from the area as an effort to become a hero. They were saying that because he worked as a security guard, he must have been a failed law enforcement officer and wanted to gain notoriety and fame. Any thoughts on that so far?
Yeah, I don't. In his interviews, he said he didn't want to be a hero. He was just doing his job. And people are going to say that, I guess. That's the right thing to say. But once the media got a hold of these sources within the FBI that they were considering him as a suspect, the media ran with it. And this was at kind of the beginning of the 24-hour news cycle. So they have to say something to keep you coming back hour after hour, right? So right. It's kind of feeding the monster.
So the FBI at this point has just completely lasered in on Jewel as their primary suspect. They interrogated him, and in the recordings of those interviews, you can see they tried to coerce him into waiving his rights. They did this by telling him that the taped interview would only be used for a film about bomb detection and was not part of a criminal investigation. This was not true, of course, and this was an effort by the FBI to coerce him into speaking. So as I'm researching this and I read about that, I'm telling myself, if you're ever interrogated by police, don't believe anything they say. Always ask for your lawyers.
Yeah, lawyer up. And
even if, like, you always assume, oh, if you lawyer up, you're guilty. No, you lawyer up to keep your butt safe, even because especially if you're innocent.
How is that not entrapment? Like, I get that the police can lie and say, oh, well, we know you were there to try to get you to confess. And I get some of those things, but how is it not entrapment to create a completely false scenario for you to tell this story?
I feel like it's not ethical at all. I mean, if it helps you catch legitimate bad guys, fine. But in Jewel's case, I just kind of feel bad for the guy, unless he is the bomber, you know? The FBI and other law enforcement officials basically harassed Jewel. They searched his home twice. They embarrassed him by tracking down his coworkers and friends and family members. And they were asking them questions about, like, what kind of habits does this guy have? And whether or not they thought this guy could be responsible for the bombing in Centennial Park. They also maintained a 24-hour-a-day tail on Jewel. And this was where an FBI agent basically followed him everywhere he went. Law enforcement and the public at large were convinced with no evidence that he was the person who planted the bomb in the park that night.
Sure, the media was feeding into this, but it also creates such an intriguing storyline of he claimed to be the hero, but he's the villain, that people like that kind of drama, I guess, is why people were buying into it. Finally, and he had been cooperative with law enforcement, and he had answered their questions, but he had had enough. He finally hired his own attorneys, and they had Jewel take a polygraph test, which he passed with flying colors. And then, after 3 months later, after the bombing, they had humiliated Jewel. The U.S. attorney sent Jewel a letter clearing him of any wrongdoing and announcing that he was no longer a suspect. Now, did that polygraph cause all that? Absolutely not. But it was a part of the puzzle of them finally really realizing, yeah, this guy couldn't have done this. So, John, he would go on to sue numerous news agencies for slander. The initial newspaper that reported that he was a suspect that kind of started this frenzy was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He sued them. He sued NBC. Most of these he settled out of court and for hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of dollars, John. But because of his attorney fees, he ended up not making that much money. He would go on to say that he was doing this not for the money, but to make sure that others didn't have similar situations where they were humiliated and villainized without any evidence. With Jewel no longer being considered as a suspect, the FBI had no viable suspects or leads to go on in this case that was in the forefront of everyone's mind. After the break, we will discuss where authorities turned for answers after clearing Jewel and the break that ultimately led to the identity of the bomber. Guys, if you haven't already tried it, John and I really want to tell you about our other podcast.
Jamie, it's called Bless Their Hearts, and it is probably the most fun that I have recording a podcast ever. We try to keep it lighthearted, and we talk about stuff that is just ridiculous and silly, but it's a lot of fun.
It's a great stress reliever and pretty much the opposite of True Crime Cast. We're going to play a quick clip to let you know a sample of what Bless Their Hearts is about.
I'll wipe grease on my jeans. Not, I won't wipe cheese on them. Don't be ridiculous, John. Sure,
Cheetos dust comes out once you wipe it on. I think it's like orange for life.
Yeah.
Like, John, that makes perfect sense.
You wear the right colors, boy. You can eat Cheetos all day long. Nobody ever knew it. So go ahead over to iTunes and download, subscribe, and start listening to Bless Their Hearts today.
Now that Jewel had been cleared, there were no leads. There was no evidence to help identify the man that had placed that bomb in Centennial Park. In early 1997, a few months after the bombing took place, there were two more bombings in the Atlanta area. One was at an abortion clinic, and the other was a gay nightclub. Investigators were convinced that these bombings were related. The bombs were constructed in a similar fashion to the one that took place in Centennial Park. And then there was a fourth bombing at an abortion clinic in Alabama that ultimately killed a police officer. And in that case, witnesses were able to get a partial license plate from a vehicle that they saw fleeing the scene. The FBI used that license plate number and vehicle description to lead them to one man, Eric Robert Rudolph. And since he was identified as the bomber at the Alabama abortion clinic, they were able to tie him to all these other bombings. He was a carpenter by trade. He had a lot of outdoor survival skills. Although police now knew that he was responsible for the bombing in Alabama and probably the ones in Georgia, they couldn't find him. They believed him to be hiding somewhere in the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina, evading capture. In 1998, 2 years after the Centennial bombing, and still without an arrest, the FBI finally named Rudolph as their chief suspect and put him on the top 10 most wanted list, charging him with all four bombings, including the one at Centennial Olympic Park. Despite being on that list, Rudolph stayed in the wilderness alone for years before he was finally captured. John, he was living in the woods, eating out of dumpsters.
Yeah, I saw that he was eating, like, he would go to dumpsters and get stuff. I saw that he would, like, steal grain from a silo on a farm. He would, like, steal vegetables out of people's gardens. He would gather acorns like a squirrel, you know? And,
yeah.
I mean, this dude was living in the woods for a while.
And he knew that the police were after him, and he would later say that he really enjoyed going to the dumpsters that were near where the FBI had set up to catch him. So he would go literally across the street from their headquarters that they'd established searching just for him and just sit and eat while looking at their offices.
That has to be like one of the traits of a serial killer, right?
Yeah.
So something else I read that was interesting was like he would be hiding in the mountains and police helicopters would fly over. And he knew they were using like thermal imaging to try to find body heat in the woods. So he remembers one cold night he had dug out from the ground like a place for him to crawl into. Basically, like he made his own cave, basically. Right. So he could remember the helicopters flying over. He was burrowed in his cave, and as the helicopter passed, he felt accomplished that he had kind of thrown off the police by building his own cave. I remember that was kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, I mean, the survival skills are kind of off the charts. I mean, for 10 years after the Olympic bombing and 8 years after the last known bombing, he was just living in the woods, not being caught.
I wanted to research a little bit more of his background because I figured that, you know, with most serial killers, we see like a troubled past. I couldn't find much about, like, was he abused as a child, stuff like that. But I thought it was interesting. What I did find was that he had kind of dropped out of school early, became a carpenter, like you said. He joined the Army, and he went through basic training and all that, and he was a member of the 101st Airborne, which is stationed out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Yeah. So,
you know, he had some ties to Kentucky, but he was discharged, not for anything like aggressive behavior or anything like that, but he was discharged for I guess he tested positive for marijuana, and he was discharged because of that. But not like a noteworthy past. I guess the thing that likely contributed the most to his ideology, and we're going to talk more about that in a minute, was his mom was raised him like in a almost like a commune or a cult, basically.
Yeah.
Known as the Church of Israel. And from everything I've read, it's basically like a extreme conservative. Like they believe people who commit abortion or have an abortion is murdering, you know, so they just had some really extreme ideology. And I think that contributed a lot to what we see from him and his criminal activity.
And it went above like disagreeing with a decision, feeling like it's wrong. Like you must stop these things from happening. We must stop this from happening in our society.
Yeah, and it wasn't like his anger, or at least the anger that I saw in researching this compound, wasn't geared towards the women that were going into these clinics, but more so geared to the doctors who were committing the abortions. calling them serial killers and that the government should go after them as criminals for what they were doing in these clinics. So on May 31st, 2003, there's a rookie cop in North Carolina, in Murphy, North Carolina, and at 4 a.m. on his shift, he drives by a store and notices something out of place. So this officer is named Jeffrey Postal, and he sees somebody loitering around the store, going through a dumpster, and that person would end up being Eric Rudolph. So Postal arrested Rudolph that night, and after his arrest, he was taken into federal custody for the four bombings attributed to him. So, Jamie, I thought it was really interesting, man. This officer is kind of just on his patrol. He notices somebody hanging out around the store. He assumes that this person is kind of breaking into the business. It was a Save-A-Lot. He assumed he was breaking into the Save-A-Lot. I'm not really sure on what grounds this officer arrested him. Like, did he, through like a just stopping and talking to him, realize this is Eric Rudolph? Or was he arrested for, I don't know. I couldn't find like on what grounds. But this guy basically arrested one of America's most 10 most wanted people on accident, right?
Yeah, and I feel like that's how it happens sometimes. It'll be a broken taillight or missing a turn signal that gets somebody pulled over when they're wanted for something awful. And I'm thankful that those things happen and people are brought to justice, but it's certainly not the way that we dramatize things in movies when they go down with big operations and big shootouts and stuff like that.
Yeah, it wasn't a raid on his, like, you know, holdout place. It was he was going through a dumpster trying to get food, and this cop thought he was also breaking into a Save-A-Lot. It's like the worst way you could go down.
Yeah.
The officer said that he had dyed his hair black. He was wearing a camouflage jacket. He was also wearing work clothes. So just really interesting. This rookie cop like saved the day and arrested one of America's top 10 most wanted people.
What a way to make your name for yourself though, right?
Right. He remained in federal custody until 2005, at which point he pled guilty to creating and planting the bombs at all four scenes. He was spared the death penalty because of his plea deal, but he was sentenced to four consecutive life sentences. Shortly after his sentencing, Rudolph made a public statement, and it's one of only a few statements that he made. Jamie, do you care to read his statement?
Sure. He said, "In the summer of 1996, the world converged upon Atlanta for the Olympic Games. Under the protection and auspices of the regime in Washington, millions of people came to celebrate the ideals of global socialism. Multinational corporations spent billions of dollars, and Washington organized an army of security to protect these best of all games. Even though the conception and purpose of the so-called Olympic movement is to promote the values of global socialism, as perfectly expressed in the song Imagine by John Lennon, which was the theme of the 1996 Games, even though the purpose of the Olympics is to promote these ideals, the purpose of the July 27th attack was to confound, anger, and embarrass the Washington government in the eyes of the world for its abominable sanctioning of abortion on demand. The plan was to force the cancellation of the games or at least create a state of insecurity to empty the streets around the venues and eat into the vast amounts of money they invested."
So, yeah, I mentioned earlier that Rudolph is an extreme conservative whose bombings were targeted at abortion providers, the gay community, and large corporations. Basically, this guy is a nutbag, right?
Yeah, it's a stance against the establishment because you believe that their ideals are corrupt. And it's in theory, a stand against corruption. You can see where somebody would trick themselves into thinking they're doing the right thing here. But how many innocent people were hurt to try to send this message?
Yeah, and this bombing at Centennial Park, like, it wasn't at an abortion clinic. I guess it was really focused more on the large corporations and just all the money the government was spending on all this security, and just as a way to, I guess, for him to stick it to the man, I guess.
But if you're wanting to send that message, how does that message get received when you just drop a bomb and go hide in the woods for 8 years?
Right. It's not until he's captured that they really get to hear from him as to why he's committing these crimes. He would go on to apologize to the families of the victims in court, but only to those killed or injured. at the Centennial bombing, he refused to apologize to the other victims of the other bombings, which, I mean, why would he apologize to some there and not everybody?
Yeah, the other bombings were at abortion clinics or a gay nightclub. So those were the people that he believed deserved to be punished in this way. But I guess he couldn't confirm who he hurt at the Olympic bombing to know whether they were involved in these activities or not.
Some other notes here. His sister made a statement to police basically saying that she believed that they did the right thing by getting him off the street and that by sparing his life and making him spend the rest of his life in jail was basically worse than the death penalty to him because it was the government basically had him locked up and he hated the government. So in her eyes, this was worse for him than the death penalty because he had to live the rest of his life knowing that the government had him and they were keeping him alive.
Yeah, it sounds like the perfect, if you're looking to punish someone who did this, and of course there was no, they're not trying to rehabilitate here. He's going to be in jail for the rest of his life.
Did you happen to read anything about his siblings? Like, most of his siblings are fine, decent people. He did have a brother that recorded a video of himself protesting some calls, and he actually in the protest had a video of himself cutting his own hand off. Did you read about that?
I have not heard that.
Doctors were able to put his hand back on and reattach it, but in a protest, this guy's brother cut off his own hand. So obviously there's some mental health problems with the men of this family. I thought that was an interesting side note.
Oh, absolutely. Very extreme beliefs, very extreme actions.
So he is confined at the Colorado Supermax prison along with several other terrorists. Fun fact, I have a good friend of mine who used to work at that prison, and I went out to Colorado to visit him when his brother was getting married, and he told me about all the people that were housed there. There's some really famous criminals who are housed in that federal prison called Colorado Supermax. He has written a couple of books behind bars. One of them was called Between the Lines of Drift, the memoirs of a militant. It was published in 2013. Fun fact about that book, the government seized all of Rudolph's profits in order to pay damages for that he owes to the victims of his crimes.
Yeah, you can't make money off of your own crime. I've always wondered that about people that write books from prison. Like, what are they trying to get? Are they just trying to control some kind of narrative, or are they hoping they get out of jail at some point, get some of the money? I don't know.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of times we say that restitution is almost never given to families, but at least all the profits didn't go to Rudolph, but went to the families of those who were injured by his acts of terrorism. Going back to Richard Jewell, he would end up dying in 2007. He would go on to live as much of a normal life as possible, even though the whole world thought of him for a long time as a suspect of this crime. He would work for a couple of law enforcement agencies. He became a police officer for a while. A major film about his wrongful harassment as a suspect in the case was made in 2019. It was entitled Richard Jewell, and it was directed by Clint Eastwood. Have you seen that film?
I have not seen that movie.
Anything made by Clint Eastwood is usually money, so I would like to watch that. Before he died and being embarrassed in the media as a wannabe cop, Jewell did become a police officer and deputy in the state of Georgia. So, interesting case all the way around, man. And I hate all the people that suffered injury and death because of Eric Rudolph. I feel really bad for Richard Jewell, just being the hero, but then soon after that, the media just completely slammed this guy. And I mean, that had to ruin a large part of his life, living your life constantly being viewed as someone who did something that they didn't actually do.
Right. And I think there are people now, like, I remember the bombing. I remember the Olympics, being really excited about the Olympics coming. I don't remember when they identified Eric Rudolph and arrested him. I think there are still people out there that if you ask them who the Olympic Park bomber was, they would say Richard Jewell still to this day.
Yeah, it's a shame that he was treated in such a way, and that, you know, I'm not going to slam the media, but they take something and run with it, regardless of the consequences it has potentially to ruin somebody's life.
Unfortunately, based on the way we see the media now, I don't think they learned a lesson here, John.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. Man, but that's all I'm going to say about that.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting case, certainly part of recent American history that was pretty important. I'm sure it shaped the way that the Olympics is governed as far as security goes. Hopefully we'll get around to the Olympics. It's been postponed to next summer. But
do you know where the Olympics are supposed to be held?
Tokyo, Japan. Supposed to be this year, has been postponed to next year, but I'm sure the security will be better there than it was in 1996.
At least there'll be more of it. I was watching the Olympics. What was the last one? Was it in Canada? I don't know. I don't remember when the last Winter Olympics happened or anything, but I always watch it in the back of my mind. I'm thinking, this is a hotbed for criminal activity. Like, there has to be so many people doing security, and they did in Atlanta that year too. They had so many unmarked police officers, like people who were just walking around plain clothed, looked like civilians, but were actually police. But you know, you can't have your eyes on everybody. You can't know what everybody is up to. And
I think it's encouraging that they were trained to deal with this, and Jewel followed his training, and ultimately he did save a lot of lives. So his story, I think, is an encouraging one of what happened at the games. But we don't want to take away from the hundreds of people that were hurt. And then one person died in Atlanta, another in Alabama. And
two people in Atlanta, because one was running, right, and had the heart attack.
Yeah, a lot of lives dramatically changed because of this.
Yeah, so that's going to wrap up this case, guys. Thank you so much for sticking around with us. If you haven't already, a way that you could help the show tremendously is by taking just a moment to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. That goes a long way as far as helping new listeners find the show, and we would really appreciate some feedback over there.
If you're interested in additional content, we put a lot over on Patreon. You can get access to that for as little as $3 a month, so feel free to join us over there as well.
Yep, thank you for everyone who's already joined, and until next crime, this has been True Crimecast.
You've listened to True Crimecast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.